Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, welcome to episode 14 of A Small Voice. This week, Mimi Molika. Mimi grew up in Sicily, where he inherited his father's passion for documentary photography at the tender age of 8. By the time he was 20, he'd made his escape to London, where he began his career assisting the esteemed architectural photographer Helen Binet. He dropped out of a photography degree to pursue a freelance career and has since covered assignments all over the world for a wide range of internationally recognised publications, as well as juggling the demands of a freelance career with his own long-term personal projects. He also finds time for some teaching and has more recently founded Offspring Photo Meet, an organisation which provides a kind of mentoring service for photographers. In Mimi's own words, it's a kind of crossbreed between a networking event and portfolio review and a tiny creative festival of photography that involves lectures, talks and debates. And you can find their page on Facebook, and the web address is photomeet.org. I didn't know Mimi. It was great to meet him. He's a very articulate, engaging and energetic presence with an infectious passion for photography and indeed life. And as such, he's the sort of bloke who comes across as a real force for good in the world. We began by talking a bit about the photographic coverage of the recent terrorist attacks in Paris. And afterwards, I think we both felt that perhaps we hadn't expressed ourselves as well as we might have liked, or that maybe the discussion was a bit cursory, which is entirely my fault. I move things along, maybe prematurely. But anyhow, we did at least throw up a few issues that are worthy of consideration. And enjoy this. Here's the force of nature. That is Mimi Molika.
Hi.
Hi, Mimi.
Hi, Ben.
Nice to see you, mate.
Likewise.
You know what I thought we'd start with? Very recently, you posted something on your Facebook timeline about the Paris atrocities, about the photography, and you suggested that it wasn't very good. And I thought, someone said it, because I was thinking the same thing, and I imagine that other people were thinking the same thing. So I was really interested to talk about that, because it did spark a little kind of mini debate there. And I thought, yeah, it's worth considering. You know, where do you stand on it? Do you on reflection, with a little bit of time having gone by, do you still feel that was the case, that the pictures were not very good?
Well, first of all, I never said that the pictures were not good. This is something that people picked up on immediately, and I just went along because I was more interested to get a reaction and to sparkle a debate. Yeah. But what I initially debated on is how the world of photojournalism covered the event, how the mainstream media in the West covered the event, and what we would have seen on a daily basis on social networks was. And I thought that was very poorly covered. The sudden nature of the attacks is one objective fact that, you know, it does condition the outcome, the photographic outcome of the coverage somehow. Mm. However, there is an attitude in the West that is very different when it comes to cover wars, war zones, or atrocities, or tragedies that come from somewhere else, and what is, you know, happening within domestic boundaries, you know. Mm-hmm. There is, I would have expected more pictures of hospitals, for instance, of injured people, interviews of people that were, you know, first eyewitnesses. And the only thing I've seen, a very pretty and moving video of a husband who lost his wife, which was done by him practically, you know. It was a very, very beautiful video, but photographically speaking, yes, some of the videos of Magnum photographers like Patrick Zachman or Alex Maioli were very good indeed, but very, very good only because they are, you know, people with they are ready to react. But yeah, they were not, photographically speaking, artistically speaking, anything outstanding. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Is, you know, the photojournalist unfortunately, I hate to talk like that, but they do win awards with photographs from wars, war zones. The pictures are, you know, absolutely artistically amazing, beautiful, awarded, exhibited, celebrated. And then in here, what came out, it wasn't outstanding at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I did kind of slightly misrepresent the point that you were making. Although I do think that the pictures were poor, to say the least. Yeah. In the most, and the, and you know, let's forget, remember these guys. You know, these were some Magnum guys who, you know, who do that stuff for a living exceptionally well for the most part. But I guess the wider point you were making was that why is there a difference between the way these things are covered, you know, in one place in the world to another place in the world, and I guess, you know, is it because it's difficult to cover this stuff on your own, in your own backyard, perhaps?
Yes, indeed. This is, first of all, something I always found, this what I call it colonialist attitude, where you become empowered when you go visit a place that is, like in Africa or in the south of the world in general, where both the international corporation or journalists or the media or photographers or whoever, they go there and they are able to manifest their grandeur of the Western savior in all the senses you like to take, yeah? Mm. And of course, there are exceptions, but generally speaking, I hate that kind of attitude of the West trying to show its benevolence side, its knowledge, its wisdom, its bravery. You know, you are just feeding a negative stereotype of the West being up there and being a kind of a benchmark in terms of what we know about justice, what we know of human rights, what we know about how the world should be, and the rest of the world being just place of wars, place of disease, place of where tragedies strike and governments are not ready, and disasters. And this is... This kind of dialectic, it's the dialectic that drove the general population to think of black people or people coming from the southeast of Asia or coming people that come from the south of the world as being perceived as less than us. This is a broad, of course, it's a very broad argument, but I see in the world of you know, mainstream media and journalism and photography, because we are talking about photography, photographers tend to cover with ease something that happens somewhere in the south of the world, and they don't seem to be that smart when it comes to cover things like in here. You know, Martin Parr, for instance, is a genius. He can teach the world how, if you want to really cover what's wrong in the world, probably you should stay here, not going to cover a war somewhere where it's you know, probably not, you're not discovering, you're not showing me something different, really. I mean, it's absolutely essential to cover wars, but not for their artistic pursuit of a career in photojournalism. Because it becomes a kind of gymnasium that everyone has to go through. You know, I remember when I started in photography, everyone in Palermo was taking pictures of the Rom, you know, the kind of gypsy camps in Palermo, in my city. That was a kind of milestone. If you wanted to become a photojournalist, you had to go to that part of town in the periphery to take pictures of these gloomy camps where mud, with you know, where informal arrangements like dwellings were, you know, built on top of the mud, and the kids were playing on the streets and they were dirty. It was looking really like what we used to call the third world, right? Mm. And this was on our backyard. You know, every city has a gypsy camp. Really. And this was the first, and I never did it. I never covered it. I refused.
Yeah, I mean, these are the sort of cliches and the tropes of photojournalism that have been around for a long time. And hopefully they're, you know, that the kind of younger generation of photographers are presumably being discouraged from perpetuating those. And obviously, yeah, it's worth saying that a lot of photographers are fighting against that these days. But in terms of the Paris thing, is it because people are more wary in Central Europe and in their own
yes.
backyard of pissing off the population, of pissing off the mainstream media?
Yes.
Because, you know, it's because if you're going to shoot pictures of, you know, death and suffering, then, you know, you're going to have to justify that in some way.
Absolutely.
Right.
It seems that, in a nutshell, I think we think that our life is worth more than the others. I think that our values are more valuable than others. I mean, we become touchy when we are taking pictures in here on the streets. Oh, did it my picture? I did ask permission. Blah blah blah. Fuck that. Mm. You know, when you go to cover something in Thailand, in India, in the Congo, you don't ask people permission.
Well, it's funny you should say that because, as far as I'm aware, that it's actually you're not allowed to shoot in Paris on the street.
Yeah, this is
anymore.
What I knew as well.
And
yeah.
And so I don't know how that works in terms of a news event like that because.
But news is news.
Right, so there's a kind of it's kind of you're excused in a way that from being a subject to that law.
I guess so.
You know, the wider point, I guess that comes up from it is, do we even need to see that stuff anymore? You know, is that a question that should be asked? Because, you know, you hear photographers say, oh well, of course you just go into autopilot and you start doing your job, and I can't help thinking, well, maybe you shouldn't go into autopilot. Maybe you should actually think about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just playing devil's advocate to a certain extent because I don't know for sure how I feel about that stuff. But if you're going to stick your camera in the face of someone, you know, who's, grieving or injured or whatever, you'd better have a damn good reason for doing it.
Indeed. As well as in Paris, as in the Congo.
Right, exactly.
I think.
There's no difference between
exactly.
that. So, I mean, I just think that you know, maybe it's thrown up some of those questions, really. And, you know, the guys who do that stuff, you know, week in, week out, I guess, you know, have a good answer for that. But I haven't spoken to any of them, so, you know, I'm speaking to you.
Absolutely. And I wasn't even there, so, you know.
No, of course. But I thought it was really interesting that someone's kind of stuck their head up, you know, from the parapet and made the point. And I'm glad you did.
Thanks.
You know. So let's talk about you a bit. You grew up in Sicily. When did you get interested in photography?
Well, since I was very little, because my father, before becoming a lawyer, was a keen photojournalist, amateur. And he was covering all sorts of different things. He was a bit of, reportage around the street. What is called non-street photography, but also reportage. He was covering the earthquake in Sicily in 68. He was covering sports event, a bit of everything, just because he had this passion. And I grew up with these prints, both black and white and color, that he was doing by himself. He was developing and printing. Mm. And, I remember myself looking more at those photographs than any children book. So I grew up with photography as being a window to a world that I didn't know. Mm. I couldn't access because I was only born in 75. Not in the 60s, but my father's photographs were showing me that world. So this was my attitude. I said, oh, wow. I said, this is real. It's not anymore like that. What was happening? So I was asking myself questions about the subjects that I, you know, that my father photographed. And this, I kind of fell in love immediately with that language. Mm. I don't know why. I cannot tell you why. I don't know. It must be something very much intimate on how, why I like this bridge between reality and representation. There is a photograph. There is this bidimensional object. It's just beautiful. It's a language that I love. Mm. It's like any form of art you might prefer it or not, and photography is one of that I prioritize, and so I started taking pictures at 8 years old.
Right,
and I was taking pictures of ducks and
yeah. So he lent you a camera to use or whatever?
No way. No, he couldn't. No. He won several Rolleiflex. He had Nikkormats, but he didn't lend me his camera up until I was 20 years old.
Okay, so he bought you a cheap camera to use?
No, he didn't buy me. The first camera was bought by my grandfather.
Oh, okay.
A hacking point and shoot. And then when I was 14 years old, he gave me the first camera, the SLR, the Pentax K1000. Mm. So I was 14 years old.
Right. And did he have photo books in the house, or was it?
Yes.
Yeah. So you kind of were.
Capa.
Ah, okay.
And Ferdinando Scianna religious parties in Sicily, and then few other annuals. You know, there were annuals of photography. They were all stuff from the 70s and early 80s, or they were beautiful. The catalogs, the yearly catalogs, these books that are sponsored by Kodak or Canon or Agfa, you know, you remember?
Yeah.
And they were photographs, both fashion, reportage, still life. But then I learned by myself because my father bought me a manual on, a user guide, a handbook on how to make photography. It was from an English dude, John Hetchko.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, famous guy, writes millions and millions of kind of how-to photography books.
And I learned with that book.
Right.
And I learned how to photograph. I learned how to develop my films, to print. I set up my darkroom with the equipment that my father had from the 60s. So I started I started developing and printing at 13 years old.
He never really lost the love of it.
No, never.
So did you imagine at that stage that it was something that one could do for a job, though?
No, never.
Right. When did that realization come?
At 20 years old.
Okay, so quite a lot
later.
Yes.
Yeah.
What were you? Hang on, your dad was he a criminal lawyer?
No, he's a civil lawyer.
Okay.
When he said he's a criminal, I said, oh my God, what did
not
I say?
Not a criminal, a criminal lawyer. Well, I'm just getting, in Sicily, I imagine there's a confusion there. That's why I was asking, because I was thinking, hang on, don't tell me your dad was a criminal lawyer in Sicily. He wasn't involved in that side of things.
No. Right? I mean, my grandfather was a judge, so if we were involved in anything, we were involved pretty much on the other side.
Well, precisely. I mean, on whichever side. I wasn't trying to suggest that there was any criminality. But, I guess that must have been interesting. Gave you some kind of perspective, maybe, that other people, youngsters had.
Well, in Sicily, I grew up by having to make choices. When I used to go out, my mother wanted to know who I was going out with, because, in my school, there were sons of mafiosi. You always needed to be careful who you are hanging out with, pretty much. Mm. Let alone the second war of mafia of the 80s, covered by Letizia Battaglia and Franco Zecchin, we grew up where every day there was someone being killed. Mm. Every day in Sicily. Some people, they were, like Judge Falcone, Borsellino, we knew them personally very well. So it's been a kind of intense way of living. But, I am absolutely, totally privileged. So I cannot complain.
Mm. But you have kind of sort of pointed your camera towards that as a subject. You did do some stuff.
Well, I am doing.
As I was going to say, are you still working? Are you still going back occasionally to work on stuff?
Well, I'm finishing. I'm on the process of closing the circle. And so I started this story in 2009. And my story is a kind of personal journey back to the Sicily that I want to highlight, and it's precisely I'd like to highlight the permanent effects of Cosa Nostra. Mm. So, Cosa Nostra as a criminal organization is not anymore that powerful as it used to be. Okay, at least not on the military sense of it. Mm. They kind of franchised the business of international drug traffic to Calabria 'Ndrangheta, which is a different region of Italy in the south.
That's Napoli, right?
No. That one is Camorra.
Oh, Camorra.
Napoli,
okay.
Is Camorra. Calabria is 'Ndrangheta. Uh-huh. Puglia is Sacra Corona Unita, and Sicily is Cosa Nostra. Now, Cosa Nostra in the 80s, with the connections with the transatlantic mafia, you know, from Canada and the States, they were very big in drug traffic, and they were among the rich. I mean, the GDP of mafia was way above the one of Italy. Now it's not longer anymore like that. So mafia itself is not any more military from the military perspective as strong as it used to be, but the effects of what it has been and what it is carrying on being, because you know you can feel the tension in other regards, it's permanent damages that cannot be repaired. Mm. And this is what I want to highlight. This is what I want to show. Not the mafia of the Godfather from Hollywood, but what is it that mafia actually did wrong? Mm. You know, what did they inflict on us, upon us, that is permanent.
Okay,
this is my story.
And so, how are you going about it? I know you've done. You've done portraits.
It's very easy. Unfortunately, it's very easy from in terms of choices of subjects, because you know the portraits are portraits of people that I see as being the portrait of an orphan, a society orphan of democracy. But then there is illegal building speculations. Mm. There are traces of remembrance of people that were killed. There are industries where mafia still is extremely, present. Mm. And there are the signs that you can see them all around in nature. Mafia poured the cement all over our coasts. They ruined permanently the beauty of Sicily. Mm. The infrastructures are not working properly. Corruption is embedded in the way of thinking of Sicilian people. Not all, of course, but you know.
So you sort of photographed some kind of landscapes as well, right?
Absolutely. The difficulties is to use sometimes the cliché for my own end. It's difficult to show something, you know, to show something that is quite broad and not falling into the cliché. Mm. I have to use the cliché. I have to show a lot more than what is it, only the permanent effects of what mafia has inflicted upon us, because I have to show the frame within which this happens. So it's easy to pick and choose the subjects because it's everywhere. Mm. But it's difficult to construct a body of work that makes sense to everyone.
Yeah,
that does not necessarily know about mafia and what they do, but it's also a very personal perspective. So there is this, there is a personal, intimate poetry within, which is, you know, what I like to define my own personal line throughout the stitches, all the pictures together. And I don't know. I hope you can tell. Mm. I mean, I shot the latest batch. It's been shot in July. 2015, just now, and actually, I want to show you some.
Yeah, I'd love to see it.
Yeah.
And so you, I mean, you feel like you pretty much finished.
Yeah.
One of the things you're kind of doing is with the portraits that you know, there's street shots and kind of playing with people's expectation. You know, some guy in the street looks a bit dodgy. You know, was that part of your intention?
Yes, I have to use a sort of language that attracts people's attention, but makes them think, makes them wonder, who is that guy looking crazily interesting in the middle of the street? Is he part of mafia? This is all what everyone asks me. And this is what I want to achieve. Mm. And I haven't taken any intentional picture of anyone belonging to Cosa Nostra. I haven't taken a picture of blood. I haven't taken pictures of guns. The only gun that you can see is the gun of one of the bodyguards of a judge. This is not my intention, but these sparkles the attention of the viewer, but also the character of the people that that I photograph is what I am really interested into. So there is this double use that I make. This is the reason when I told you that, when I said that I want to use the cliché to my ends.
Yeah.
Because on the one end, people is attracted by these portraits or other photographs. And on the other hand, these people, you know, they really portray the character of Sicily. It's something where I'm trying to convey what it feels, what Sicily feels like. It's a bit archaic, a bit orphan of democracy. It's a bit mysterious, a bit worn out. The tension that you feel, it's real, it's there, and it's not a joke. And it's all these kind of bits and pieces that I'm trying to put together. So the editing process will be really, 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 really difficult. Mm. But I'm close to make a book. So
I was going to say, so it's going to be a book, I presume, yes. Or you hopefully it will
yes.
be. Well, great. And what's the time frame, do you reckon?
I don't want to say anything about it. No. I have a meeting very soon.
Okay.
But I cannot tell anything.
We don't want to jinx anything. and we don't want to give too much
away. I'm super superstitious.
No, absolutely. Well, you know, that's great. It's good to know. We'll park it and then
yes.
Maybe I'll talk to you again. Yeah. You know, when it's you know, further down the road. So basically, you're saying around 20, you figured maybe you could actually do it for a living.
Yes.
Were you still in Sicily or had you?
No,
come
I moved.
Over here?
I moved in London on the 1st of January 1996.
So you were still pretty young at that point.
Yeah. Now is actually this in a month time. I will have spent half of my life in Sicily, half of my life in here.
Wow.
This is like a
It's been your home
date.
For a while. Yeah. So what brought you here?
Boredom.
Yeah. Were you somehow trying to escape that kind of... Because I can imagine it was kind of small.
I guess I wanted to. I wanted to. But it wasn't only that. It was a bit because I wasn't doing fuck all. Mm. A bit because I didn't want to be in a place where, you know, if you have to do something, you can do it only by asking a favor. But also is not. I mean, this is the way I was thinking then. But then again, I know people, friends of mine that honest friends of mine. You know, that do their own work. And, you know, despite all the shit that is going on in Sicily. So, you know, chapeau to them.
Right.
But, you know, I was 20 years old, I wanted a bit of adventure, I wanted an escape from that context, I wanted to explore new things. I said to myself, I was born here, I come from Sicily, but I'm not only a Sicilian, I'm a citizen of the world and I have to explore it. And I think that I thought that London was, you know, the good. In fact, I did eventually travel across the continents.
Yeah.
Because of my work. So.
Yeah, of course. So when you got here, how was it? Did you immediately try and start working as a photographer?
As an assistant.
Oh, okay.
I assisted Hélène Binet, architectural photographer, for a year and a half. And she taught me a great deal of stuff. I mean, we are friends now. We very close. She still... I still see her as my mentor, even though we are mates, you know?
Yeah.
But she's a great, great photographer, great artist, great person, great mother, great wife. She's a great, great, truly great person.
What would you say, what were the things that you learned, or some of the things that you learned? What was the most important thing, perhaps, that she taught you?
Well, the poetry of photography.
Because your heart was more in documentary rather than...
Yes, totally. I always disliked profoundly architectural photography. Right. I still don't like it.
So you weren't interested in the stuff you
Not
were shooting?
At all.
But you were, you know, you were still getting something from her
I wasn't
as a interest, mentor?
Yeah, because I wasn't interested on what she was shooting. I was interested... in how she was shooting it.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
And I think this is valid for everything. You might dislike rock, but that doesn't stop you from appreciating the way rock is played, you know? I don't like rock, I don't listen to rock, but when there is a Pink Floyd playing a tune or someone, doing psychedelic, you still appreciate art.
Yeah. You can appreciate the craft of it, and
exactly
right. So you were working with a photographer who was in a genre that you had no interest in,
no.
And yet you still managed to get something out of it. And how did you kind of break free of the assisting thing? Because I guess a lot of people have to make that decision as to when to go off on their own. How did you come about that process?
Well, a kind of how do you say when a lot of things come together, a confluence of factors. I was assisting Hélène. I was doing my BA at LCP, what is called now LCC, I guess.
Yeah, London College of Communication. Yes. Was London College of Printing.
Yes,
same
exactly.
Place I went to, and probably just about 80% of the people I've interviewed so
yes,
far did.
Exactly. So. But I guess you never interviewed a dropout.
Oh, you
I
left?
Dropped out. Yes,
okay. All right.
I hated that too. You know.
Right.
So anyway, I was doing. I was assisting. I was doing the BA. I was working as a photographer. You know, here and there, small jobs, I was also working at nights in a pub in Brixton where I was living. So at one point, I wasn't even earning as assistant. You know, she wasn't paying me much. Now she has 2, 3, 4 assistants. They all paid monthly. Before, not. It wasn't like that.
Sure.
It was really a friendship, which I totally appreciate. But I didn't have much time. Couldn't anymore have much time, to assist Hélène. And after a year and a half, you feel like you've done an experience. It's beautiful. Why stretching things too much? I don't like to stretch things. I don't like to stretch anything.
Yeah, I guess some people. I suppose it's really about that slight fear of taking the leap, and sometimes you can get kind of caught in the place where you're sort of a little trapped, and you have to somehow kind of cut free. But wait, you didn't finish your BA. So what was wrong with that? Then you were doing a degree.
Yeah.
Some people do the MA course or whatever, but. What did you...
Well, I didn't like the tutors.
Right.
The first assignment was take pictures of London. I said, okay, do you have any guidelines? They said, no, you are free to do whatever you want. Okay, so I went out with my Nikon, took pictures on the streets. It was, my own interpretation of how London can make an individual feel lonely. You know, I was only 20 whatever years old, 21, 20, you know, a young photographer. I'm in love with Magnum photographers, with an approach of, you know, reportage, black and white, developing, printing my own things. It was a romantic view of loneliness in London. Okay, so I hang my pictures for the assessment. They had a quick look and they said, they referred me. They said, no, it was not good enough. I said, okay, fair enough, but why? They said, well, it's not good enough. I said, I got that, but why? They said, well, it's not good enough. I said, okay, let me tell you what. I come in here, I work at night to earn my money. I am taking this very, very seriously. And if you are not able to tell me what is wrong with me, I do nothing here. So if I have to get a bad answer about my pictures, I go to the New York Times, I show my shit photographs, and they tell me, no, it's not good enough. Thank you very much. But you are my tutor, and you're supposed to give me reasons to articulate where I have shortcomings.
Going wrong.
Exactly.
Seems pretty fundamental
exactly.
to me.
Exactly. And so because they weren't ready to do so, I said, fuck you, and I left. And now one of the pictures that I took, that they referred, they is on the permanent collection of the Museum of London.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes.
Well, that's all you really need to say. And you've continued to work, you know, to shoot in London. I know the first thing of yours that I saw was you did some sort of CCTV stuff from the buses.
Yes.
And you had a little kind of almost a joint exhibition with
George Georgiou. Yes.
Who was had just at that point started working on his bus project, which is now obviously a book, Last Stop. But and that was at the London photo. What was it? London Street Photography
Festival,
which was kind of a short-lived thing, unfortunately. But how did you come by that idea, or how did that develop into a project? That idea.
Well, I was running my very first workshop, online workshop, the Photowrap series of workshops, and I had brilliant students, and you know, I got inspired to shoot more myself, because when you teach, you always learn. And this idea came about to me, and I said to myself, I'm gonna shoot the monitors displaying what the CCTV cameras installed inside the buses would capture. And the reason behind it is that by teaching a workshop and the photographers being street photographers, you know, the students that were coming in. They asked me a lot about street photography, ethics, taking pictures, permissions, this and that. I said, what the fuck are you talking about? Permissions, this and that. We are constantly photographed by CCTV cameras everywhere we go. You come out from your house and you are not longer a free individual because they cover. Now, let alone if, you know, Just forget about for a second if it's good or bad or blah, blah, we need it or don't. I don't want to get into this. What I want to get into is that we are constantly watched and we do not perceive this. Especially, there is the gimmick element of the CCTV cameras being installed in different parts of the double deck, but only a monitor being installed in on the no, actually two monitors, I think, one in on where the stairs are, and one on the lower deck. However, anyhow, this was becoming my back LCD back of the camera, and I was practically using the CCTV as the lens and the monitor as my LCD.
Right.
And I was taking pictures of people that weren't at all aware of my presence. Because if a camera was depicting someone right on his face and this person was on the upper desk and I wasn't on the upper desk while I was on the lower deck, my presence as a photographer wasn't perceived at all.
Right.
But when this my presence was perceived from people that was at the same deck where I was taking pictures of, hell broke loose, of course. And I said, don't you realize that I'm taking pictures of something that is already picturing you? So why do you get upset with me? And so this is been a kind of loop exercise for me to show that we are always constantly on the public eye.
Mm. Well, that's it's a good point. And it's kind of, almost mirroring what we started out talking about. There are certain aspects of that debate that we were kind of touched upon when talking about Paris. But I guess, perhaps the reason that people get upset or question, being photographed is because we are, under such surveillance. I mean, there is a distinction, I suppose. If you are being... surveilled, if that's a word, without your knowledge, then that's one thing. But if someone photographs you and you see them photographing you, then, maybe you have a right to question what they're doing.
I don't think so. Because there is a fine balance, of course, between what you like or what you don't like. Or you come out from the house and you lose a huge portion of your privacy. That doesn't mean that CCTV camera is justified, but you do lose your privacy. You don't go out on the streets naked, do you? But you can go naked in your own house. So your privacy is stopped. There are issues related to it. I don't deny that. But you cannot as well forbid photographers to take pictures. I am free to turn my head, to cover my head. I am free to walk around, or I am free to put my hand in front of the camera. As long as I don't touch you, I can do it. But you cannot be aggressive to me. I don't think you can. I mean, how can you stop that? How can everyone has a camera? Everyone. Mm. How can you stop this? We become a kind of paranoid society. Now, CCTV is one thing. CCTV is, to me, represents a tool from the corporations to protect themselves. And they use this to restrict. It's a kind of extended arm of a military state. Private security, CCTV cameras, private lands, especially London, is becoming all private. And so you are not free to walk anymore. Now, why do you have to take out of my freedom, my artistic freedom, to take pictures around? What will we have if I am not taking pictures on the streets? How will we remember what we were?
Hmm.
How can we do it? We cannot do it. There will not be any testimony of what we are. So I don't complain if you don't want to have the picture taken. Okay, cover yourself, but don't aggress me.
Mm.
Don't stop me. You can stop your face to be photographed, but you cannot stop me photographing or attempting to photograph. If someone on the streets take a picture of my daughter or me and my wife, I don't care. I mean, I cover if I don't like it.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. We kind of took a leap there because we went from you sort of quitting your photographic education to then actually, becoming a teacher of other people. So there's a big gap there, that I guess we didn't cover, but. Well, back to the buses, really, as a kind of ongoing thing. But I think in the wake of the London bombings, you did a project about the number 30 bus, which I think you kind of you won a prize in the Hodge Award, which is one of the well-known awards we have here in the UK. Tell me about that one, about the number 30.
When the London bombing happened, I was together with the international photographic community in Arles. And of course, you can understand having my sister here and all my friends, I was pretty much touched. And I couldn't use, my phone. I tried to contact anyone, say, how are you? I couldn't use my phone because, being being with T-Mobile and the bombing, you know, the networks were affected here. Anyway, as soon as I came back to London, I wanted to speak about this, about what happened. And I wanted to identify what was the most relevant things to say about the bombing. And what was relevant was the strength of Londoners to stand up the next day and keep on going normally as nothing had happened, going on doing their own thing. Now, that doesn't mean that people are stupid. Of course, people have feelings and people were scared. But fear is part, is a human feeling and is a noble, if not precious, human feeling, because fear prevents you from being hurt. Fear is an honest human feeling. So yes, fear was to be detected, but people was still boarding the very same bus that was blown up on that day. Now, because that happened to be the bus that I was taking every day, I could have been on that bus. My sister could have been on the bus. My girlfriend could have been on the bus. Everyone that I know could have been on the bus. That bus for me meant a lot. And because you know there was this tension going on, despite the fact that everyone was on the streets, everyone was boarding the bus, everyone was, you know, just carrying on with their own lives. I said to myself, I will photograph that reality. This is a very small, narrow down perspective that probably will help me suggest more things about London, about London, about the reaction. So I took photographs of the Route 30. Of both people boarding the bus or waiting for it. And I was lucky enough to be awarded.
Yeah, it was what I kind of, I guess, kind of classify as a simple idea, but you know they're always the best ones, I think.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes.
Well executed, and people can see that on your website, obviously, if they want to know kind of how you did it, how you shot it. More up to date. You've got this little, you've got a project going involving your daughter.
Yes, Nora there.
And what's her name?
Nora.
Nora. And she's how old?
She's just over 2.5.
Okay. So tell me about that.
Well, this project started because I wanted to, when you become a father, one of the daily activities is to bring your daughter around with the pushchair, hoping she will fall asleep eventually, you know. And because I'm a photographer, because I feel always the urge to take pictures, I started taking pictures of this buggy against the gloomy backdrop of the estates in Hackney. And then as I show these pictures to my friends, and you know, I thought of doing, of taking pictures of this buggy against these contrasty backgrounds. And then, you know, eventually human figures started to enter the frame somehow. And then I said to myself, you know what? I will do only pictures with human beings rather than the buggy against a humanless backdrop. And the idea of taking pictures of her along with the strangers, with complete strangers, came through quite suddenly. And so I started to take pictures of my daughter, Nora, that I placed, sometimes asking permission, sometimes without asking anything. I placed beside strangers, and I shot a photograph with my iPhone. And so the project started taking shape, and I started putting these pictures on Instagram. And the people was, you know, word of mouth, they started following, and I have hundreds of followers now on, you know, I know it's not a lot, but I don't care about the hundred thousands of followers. For me, a true follower that, you know, looks at these pictures, especially it's my daughter, you know, it's enough. So a few hundreds make me already happy, but I don't do these for the audience. I do it because this project made me think a lot about yes, fatherhood or my daughter or the London. And then eventually, when I started thinking about London, I realized that this project is not about my daughter. Even though it's called Nora There, this project is about a cross-section of Londoners or a cross-section of wherever I took this, you know, I made the 95% has been shot in London, but I've got pictures also from somewhere else. And I think that by taking pictures of my daughter with complete strangers, I was exploring more the strangers than my daughter.
Right.
My daughter was an accent on the people that I was taking pictures of. Sometimes the way Nora looked at the other people made them ridiculous somehow. Some other times she was highlighting their beauty, or sometimes she was just posing as a contrast to that person, to what that person meant. And I like the fact that she was semi-conscious, and somehow her presence became more and more ghostly. Somehow there was this presence of Nora that was less physical and more idealistic somehow.
Right.
And I stopped it as soon as she started becoming more conscious, because then it could have, there was the risk to become something, you know, annoying to her.
Right.
Because she could have started saying, oh, why do I have to sit together, you know, pose together?
Yeah, it's almost like imposing your demands on her.
So I stopped as soon as this could have become a risk.
Yeah, so you got it done while you could, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I guess people will hopefully be able to see that project at some point. It's not actually on your website at the moment. But,
no, not
but
yet.
It will be eventually. Let's talk about the other thing that you're involved with, which is Offspring Photo Meet.
Yes.
Well, not involved with, but you actually began. That's a thing we have here in London. Well, maybe you want to explain what it is.
Yep. Well, PhotoMeet is an organization that celebrates photography, okay? So this is the Offspring PhotoMeet. It's one part of it, and it's a kind of a crossbreed between a networking event, portfolio review, and tiny, small, creative festival of photography that involves lectures, involves talks, debates, photo quiz, an award for the best portfolio. And it's a gathering that I think was needed in London. You know, it's wide enough to embrace several kind of photography, because nowadays we have to accept the fact that the different boundaries between different kind of photographies is getting more and more blurred. So fine art and documentary are pretty much the same thing, or the approach to it, it's pretty much similar. And I thought that it would have been unprecedented creating an environment where everyone could talk, live, breathe the photography for 2 days while learning, and also, you know, trying to push the career up.
Do you remember the moment when you first kind of had the idea?
Yes.
Well, tell me about that.
I was proposed to run a workshop in a location on the canal, and I didn't want to run yet another workshop, because I run several workshops. I have my own. I'm called here and there to do lectures or workshops. So I said, what is the point of doing again something like that? Why not running something together with more people that could be more interested? Plus, I had the idea of creating an interdisciplinary group back in 2000. I created this thing called RICE, and it was a group of photographers, agronomists, poets, architects, designers, and we were working on theme-based projects, from, you know, approaching whatever content or subject from different perspective. So I always wanted to work with other people. I like working in groups. I think that As an individual, you can do great things, but as a group, you can do greater stuff. And so I said, I started calling my friends, photographers, editors, publishers. I said, hey, how about running a sort of workshop thing, a two-day thing in this location that could be a cool thing to do? You know, we can, you know, we see how it goes. We split the things and we will see where we will go. And actually became clear that this was a beautiful thing to do.
Mm. I mean, has it sort of exceeded your expectations?
Yes.
In a way? Yeah, it has.
By far.
Okay, great.
Yes, by far.
Well, I mean, did you think of it in terms of an income stream, or was it more a kind of labor of love?
Labor of love. I mean, I still haven't earned anything from it.
Right.
But because I don't care. I mean, the dream is a dream, and you do it, and then eventually you will earn. That doesn't mean that I make it without thinking about it. I know that I'm investing my time, and so far it's going great. It has made me rich, of course, but what did, you know, you cannot pretend that the first time of creating something new, you know, you have to learn how to do things. You have to learn how to run a business. You have to learn how to run an event.
How to do a podcast.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Well, you can teach me about it.
Well,
But we run also free workshops, for instance.
Right.
At the PhotoMeet, at the Offspring PhotoMeet, which is a beautiful thing. Mm. So we have portfolio reviews, we have talks, we have free workshops open to all. We are planning to do exhibitions. We are planning a lot more stuff.
So you've got ambitions for the
thing. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I guess one thing I was going to kind of ask you about portfolio reviews is, whether there's an element of a kind of downside to them, which is that everyone's got an opinion. And, if you're a photographer who is seeking the input of someone who you perceive to be knowledgeable or experienced, if one person says one thing and one person says another, then where does that leave you?
Well, it depends on what you want to achieve from that person. If I want to have, I'm a photographer and I might want to hear what a photographer I esteem has to say about my work. You know, if, for instance, take my work on Sicily. I might be lost halfway through, and I might say, maybe, you know, that photographer can help me, you know, with a perspective on it. And so I go seek the advice of someone who might help me getting a different, it's something that we photographers, we often do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peer to peer.
It's a very important thing.
There is also the element of going to people that are, you know, publishers, editors, both because you probably have, you know, you esteem their position, experience, and, you know, you value their opinion, or maybe also because you just want to show something that might become an opportunity to pitch your own work. Mm. So there is different levels to be identified with a portfolio review. You can take it as a in the advisory capacity. You can take it as an opportunity to pitch your work. You can take it as an opportunity to get the world know about who you are. And because we also run the Best Portfolio Award, this becomes a true opportunity to have exposure.
Mm.
And we are planning to offer more exposure to the photographers who participate to it. So this is at the core of PhotoMeet, to offer to celebrate photography, to celebrate the photographers that come, show the work. And, you know, we promote everyone who participates to it. We act as an amplifier of what they do. For instance, Rahel Krabichler, who won the second prize of the first Best Portfolio Award, she's now featured in a upcoming book from a, you know, prominent publisher, and that's fantastic. And it wouldn't have happened if she wouldn't have come to us. Some other photographers have won awards. Some other photographers have won commissions. So this becomes, you know, you steer the industry. You act as a bridge. This is what we are. We act as a bridge between the photographers and the history industry. Then we celebrate photography, so we tend to create a debate to bring more content and to deliver content to the photographic community. So this is what we are trying to do.
Yeah. No, well, long may it continue. I think it is a brilliant idea. But I guess I was just really, I was thinking in terms of, you know, a friend I know who's kind of got a project and you know, and did a portfolio review. And you know, I mean, some people who were, you know, extremely experienced and in high esteem in the industry, you know, didn't get it really. And then some people do get it, and I guess the message is, you know, you can't really put too much store in any one person's opinion. You're just really collecting different opinions.
Of course. But also, I mean, no one forces you to go speak to someone. You choose to speak to that someone, and if you choose to speak to that someone, that means that you have to have somehow value their opinion. No one is giving you the photographers can choose who they speak to. You know?
No, of course, yeah.
So this is, you know, is something that it goes without saying. If I show my photographs to a friend I value a lot, if he or she tells me that my work sucks or my work is brilliant, I will kind of capitalize as much as I can in the opinion and try to articulate. With, you know, to enter into a dialectic with that opinion. You know, you don't have to take everything as a kind of block of truth.
Sure.
You can interact with opinion. You can debate about things. You can create better work for sure, more than if you don't show your work to anyone.
Mm.
I mean, remember that your work is yours until you decide to show it to other people in whatever form you want. And then eventually this work is like a baby, will gain its own independence.
Right.
And it will be taken, it will have a history, it will be published, exhibited, hopefully awarded, and it will be viewed by different people, and it will be judged, and, you know, that's beautiful, you know. It's what we do it for.
Mm.
I have many books of photography, and every time I go back to them, I see different things. And the photographs are the same. The imagination is the same. You know, it's beautiful how the same person can see the same work over and over again and see different stuff to it.
Yeah.
You know, good photography is like cheese. It has to mature.
Yeah. So how optimistic are you about photography in general, you know, at a time when things are changing extremely rapidly and dramatically in some respects?
Very good, very positive.
You think it's
change is very good?
Change in general?
Well, yes, but change is, it means life. If something is still, is dead. If something is changing, is evolving, it's life. It's something that people uses. It changes.
Well, things equally become extinct in the same way that they evolve. So, you know, I'm wondering,
extinction
about
is part of change. We cannot we cannot block it. You know, we cannot do anything about it. And if I don't think photography will extinct ever. I mean, we will always have the need for images. What changes is the industry, how you make money with it, or the language evolves, or, you know, we try to explore different contents in different ways. But this is good. This is time for photography has never been so exciting. Of course, for professional photographers, there is a bit of a backlash. There is less need to commission a photographer to take that picture there because that picture came from the phone of an amateur. That's okay, that's bad, that's sad, but what can you do? I mean, I think it's fair enough.
Yeah.
We have to be smarter. We are pushed and challenged to create more and better. Now, as professional photographers, and we must take the challenge. Otherwise, we can just, you know. Otherwise, the game is too easy. What do? You keep on creating bullshit because you don't have competitors. Then where is the growth of the world? What do we? You know, we photographers, we are supposed to educate people with our images. If you don't accept the challenge that come from whatever person, whatever kid with a phone, how good is your photography? You know? then yes, you are dinosaur. But you know, I'm not interested in dinosaurs. I'm interested in what you know, what changes. And you know, you look at my bookshelves, and I love it. You, there is any book for any kind of state of mind or emotional state that I am into. Even stuff that I don't like, I like, because I learn from it. So photography, yes, it couldn't be a better moment for photography.
Well, that is a very good point at which to stop, Mimi. But I feel like we could talk all day, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future. But in the meantime, you know, show me some pictures.
Yeah, great.
Thank you so much, mate.
My pleasure. Thank you.